I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We are here for our 8th annual Annapolis Summit in Annapolis, Maryland. And we want to thank our partners, the Baltimore Business Journal, who helped us do this every year the last 8 years. WEAA-FM in Baltimore, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, where this will be airing. This year, back with us, is Stevenson University as one of our main partners and sponsors. Kevin Manning is president in the audience here this morning. The Real Estate Education Association and the Greater Baltimore Committee as well. We also want to thank the Baltimore City Office of Cable and Communications, Channel 25. This year they are taping and shooting us as well. So we welcome all these new partners to this effort here for Annapolis Summit. And for the 8th year in a row, returning in their same positions, Mike Miller, President of the Senate, and of course Michael Bush, Speaker of the House. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Do appreciate you coming here every year for
our listeners
and the people of Maryland. So this is, my guess is that in all the time both of you have served in your positions in the Senate and the House, this may be the toughest economic time either one of you have seen in your positions.
Probably, close. The early 1990s was tough. We've gone through maybe perhaps four recessionary periods since I've been in the General Assembly, and this is the toughest. The early 90s was very, very tough because instead of a recession that was going on and you could continue to deal, it would come in spurts, so the counties would have to deal with it every 2 months. They'd have to go back to the drawing board every 2 months. So it's better to know what we're in again. We're in there for a long haul. We're going to come out. It's going to be a long haul coming out, but at least we know what we're dealing with and we can plan for it. We planned for it in 2007, and we thought we were in good shape. We anticipated at this time we'd have, dealing with $17 billion. Instead, we got $13 billion. So at least we know what we're up against. And unlike our sister states, we haven't had to make the cuts that they've had to make in the last couple of years. This year is going to be cutting time, and it's going to be difficult. But it's not anything that we haven't dealt with in the past.
Yeah, I think that President Senate makes good observation. I would say the one thing that I think that is different between the early 90s was that the recession basically was centered in the Mid-Atlantic states because of the lack of funding that came out of the federal government for defense spending after the Cold War stopped. I think now you're in the national recession, and what takes place has a lot to do with what the national marketplace and temperature is out there as well. I do think we're in better shape thanks to the 2007 session where we did pass revenues. We thought those revenues would meet our appropriate needs coming into this session. As the President said, we expected $17 billion. We're going to be about $13.2 billion. So it's going to be some challenging times. So you have to make decisions of what your priorities are and what you believe in. We've been very fortunate in making those decisions to continue to invest in education for 3 years in a row now. We've been number one in the country as far as K-12 is concerned, and we've been able to keep tuition affordable for higher education for middle-class families. So we've been able to accomplish a lot in those times, but it's going to be more challenging this year.
So what do you both think? What has to – I mean, this is, you're going to have – some things have to go. I mean, we look at what's going on in California and Illinois – facing much larger deficits than we're facing, but they're bigger states. They're also democratically controlled in terms of the party control of the House and the governor's mansion. They're talking about raising taxes in both those states, as well as pretty draconian cuts that the governor of California announced the other day. And those cuts are just very severe, to the bone almost, for some things. I mean, talk about what you think.
We look at our sister states. I mean, New York, California, Florida, Arizona, Michigan, Arizona. These states are in much worse shape than we are. I mean, look at what they've done. I mean, they've knocked very deserving people off the scholarship rolls. They've knocked very deserving people off the welfare rolls. They've cut Medicaid. They've cut in Virginia, they cut education spending. Colorado, they cut education spending. The state of Florida has increased tuition in public universities by 32%. None of those are palatable, but all of those are certain options that are available to the state.
We have these real cuts we have to look at, and we got to figure out where they're going to happen. And we're talking about the taxes we may have to raise just to keep things going the way they are.
Well, because we raised taxes in 2010, and because the governor says that he wants to demonstrate that he can put the state on sound fiscal footing without raising taxes, it's going to be, I don't know that taxes are in the equation this year. We've raised taxes before. 2007, an income tax, a sales tax. And so I think the governor wants to try his hand at cutting the budget. Now, we've done we've cut 5,000 jobs out of our budget. We've cut over $5 billion in our budget. But the problem this year is that the federal investment that we made in the Recovery and Reinvestment Act is gone.
Right, and not coming back.
And it's not coming back. And this budget deficit is composed of Medicaid, it's composed of K-12, and it's composed of teachers' pensions. Now, the governor's going to look at all three, and he's going to be making some adjustments, and we're going to have to see what adjustments he makes before we respond in kind.
Yeah, I think, look, you have to start here with the governor presents the budget, and in Maryland, the legislature can only cut, we can't shift. So when he presents his budget, obviously he has stated that he's going to balance the budget without any revenue increases. So I think what happens when the budget is presented, obviously there'll be significant cuts to local governments. There'll be both the cities and the counties will probably experience a lack of highway user money. Many of those municipalities use that as their general fund money. So there will be significant pain, if you will, at the local level. Our budget is driven, like the president said, by the education system, K-12. A $13.2 billion budget, $5.7 billion goes, K-12 education goes directly through to the counties. $3.2 billion goes into Medicaid funding. Our Medicaid rolls are increased 250,000 individuals because of the eligibility, because those that are unemployed, can't get work, have no employment, qualify for Medicaid. And we have to match that. That's a federal mandate. The states have no option there. So as you run into a recession, you have more people eligible for Medicaid. You have more people with needs. You have all these mandates in the budget. Fact of the matter, the No Child Left Behind Act, while it didn't carry a mandate for spending to meet the criteria, you had to have funding for it. So we passed Thornton. We've managed to do that. But I think the governor is the one who brings the budget. If there's some kind of reaction from county executives and city governments to come to Annapolis, say, look, you know, this is not palatable for us. We have to look at some alternatives. Then I think many members of the General Assembly and the governor will get together and see if you need some kind of increased revenue somewhere.
Now, that's a little bit different view. You're saying no increased revenues.
Well, this is what the governor's proposing. I consider myself a statesperson. I'm willing to vote for revenues, but at the same time, we need to see what the governor's budget is going to be about. I mean, we need to see how deep the cuts are going to be. You don't tax people just because you have the power to tax. That power to tax is a power to destroy. You impose taxes because there's a definite need, and that need needs to be filled. What we have to see is the governor's budget. For whatever reason, he keeps it held very close to his chest. And he hasn't discussed it with either the speaker or myself, and we're waiting to see where his priorities lie. The budget is morally what we're all about. We're going to see what Governor O'Malley is morally all about when we see what his budget is. We haven't seen that, where his priorities are.
Right. So, I mean, but you guys have been in this business for a long, long time.
Right.
But what's your gut instinct about where you think this is going to go? What is going to be said?
Well, let me just.
What do you think is going to happen?
He doesn't have any choice. He's got to go to education. We're number one in the state for 3 years. That's because we continue to increase funding education year after year after year after year. We send it to the counties, you know, and it's going to have to be cut. This Medicaid, the rolls continue to increase. They're going to have to be cut. We have the world's largest estuary, the Chesapeake Bay, and we can protect that by providing more and more funds for the environment, program open space. We take transfer tax money and spend it on program open space, but yet our state employees are being furloughed for the fourth year in a row. How do you justify spending money on property when real lives are at stake? You know, these are some of the areas he's going to have to cut: Medicaid, education, and environment.
Let me just follow up here. We'll probably have another 12 furlough days for state employees. It's unfortunate. Dedicated employees.
Furlough days.
I'd say it's about $80 million. I don't see that the governor can avoid furloughing state employees once again. He will cut highway user money to local governments. That means there's no transportation programs coming out of local governments unless they're going to raise their own revenues. The Maryland General Assembly, who raised taxes in 2007, also witnessed many local governments reducing property taxes. They have no incentive to raise any further revenues unless local governments and local councilmen and local commissioners come and say the need is so great that we're going to come to Annapolis, testify in support of those revenues. If they don't want to come to Annapolis and testify in support of the revenues, what's the incentive for a member of the General Assembly on their own to raise revenues if, in fact, the governor's not on board with that? The issue with Medicaid is, while we cannot reduce the eligibility for someone qualifying for Medicaid. Where you will make the cuts is in reimbursement to providers. So your physicians, your nurses, right. your nursing homes, your hospitals are all going to get cut, probably in the area of about $500 million if you're going to balance this budget. So you're going to have cuts to education, you're going to have cuts to Medicaid, you're going to have furloughs for state employees, you're going to have reduction in public safety and police aid to local governments, and you're going to have a reduction in highway user money to local governments coming in the governor's budget. Now the question is, what is the response from the advocates for health care, for the advocates for education, for the advocates from your sister public employees and representatives at the county and city level?
So we reached a point in our society where government just can't do anymore, that we've reached a point economically that we can't really take care of, that pensions are in danger for retirees, that we can't afford to take care of people's health care, the environment can't be tackled in the way it needs to be, because, I mean, we saw the reports coming out about the Bay and what you were just saying about how you have to balance that. I mean, have we reached a point where these questions can no longer be answered?
This is all about political will. There's no state out there that put themselves into a recession. And 50 states didn't mismanage their programs.
Right.
You know, county governments didn't mismanage their budget. City governments didn't manage. There was a mismanagement on the national level of the financial institutions and basically Wall Street. We're here because of the collapse of Wall Street 2 years ago. That's why we're here. The president tried to build a bridge for governments to be able to respond and keep their programs in place by passing the ARRA money. Congress does not have the political will again to extend that. So states either have to build a bridge, a temporary bridge, until the economy returns, or you have to face the cuts, because unlike the federal government, we have to balance our budget. They don't have to balance their budget. I mean, so the needs from the states are going to be screaming at Washington, just like the needs from the counties are going to be screaming to their elected officials in the state.
And the chance of money coming from Washington at this point is
Well, it's getting
slim.
Worse and worse, obviously. But, I mean, not only the Recovery and Reinvestment Act dried up, but, I mean, what you lose sight of is the people have spoken. I mean, they've spoken loud and clear all across the United States. I mean, I have colleagues all around the United States that are defeated. 700 legislators are gone now because the public says we want our cake and we want to eat it too. You know, we want everything. We want health care. We want the environment. We want education. But we don't want to pay for it. And so as a consequence, if you were an incumbent, whether you're Republican or Democrat, the public lashed out and put new people in office. So it's incumbent upon legislators now to listen to what the public said, but at the same time to not lose sight of where we have been in the past and how we're going to continue to move on in the future. I have voted for taxes in the past. I'll continue to vote for taxes in the future. But at the same time, we need to see where our priorities are, and we're not going to see that until we see what the governor's budget is all about.
So when we talk about taxes, gasoline tax?
It's a possibility. Again, you know, it's been hiked at least two or three times in my tenure here in Annapolis, but it's always been an initiative by the governor. The governor's gone for legislators and said, look, you're in Western Maryland, you want 270 taken care of. You know, you need to vote for that budget. You need to vote for the gas tax. You're on the Eastern Shore, you want 404 taken care of. You need to vote for the gas tax increase. You know, you're in the Washington metropolitan area, I need the ICC funded. I need the Purple Line funded. You're in Baltimore, you want the Red Line funded. You know, a governor's got to work. I mean, the governor's got to spend political capital like he did in 2007 to get his slots, tax, and cuts. He's going to have to work hard and spend political capital to make it happen. We, as willing advocates, are going to help him, but he's going to have to lead on this in this matter.
Now, delegates I've talked to from your house have said to me, when they knocked on doors campaigning, all their constituents said, no new taxes.
Right. Let me just say this about taxes, because I think the rhetoric of that over the last 10 years has been very effective. But the fact of the matter, I pay less taxes today than I paid 20 years ago. I mean, we haven't raised the gas tax since 1992. The state of Maryland reduced the income tax 10% from 5% to 4.75%. We did raise the depending on the sales tax. We've extended exemptions to $3,200 per individual. So a family of four doesn't pay any income tax on its first $16,000. I've gotten at least three reductions in my federal income taxes, where in my tax bracket I've saved $4,000 a year. So, I mean, I pay maybe $150 more a year in state taxes. I get a benefit of about $4,000 in reduction from my federal taxes because of the Bush tax cuts. The fact of the matter is that we've been able to keep services to a level that I think people appreciate. But we're to the point now, without any federal funding, that those services, those investment in those services are not going to be there anymore. So the people that want new schools or that now have 20 children in the classroom are going to have 25 children in the classroom. And those who are going to have to pay more for college tuition are going to say, you know, what happened? You can't have it all. I mean, you can only spend what you bring in. The fact of the matter is, for our overall government, of our general fund budget, only 4% goes to state employees. 4%. 50% goes in education, higher education, and K through 12. 50%. That's a direct pass-through. Almost 30% goes into health care, your Medicaid. 80% of your Medicaid dollar goes to senior citizens, mentally disabled and developmentally disabled. They're the people in nursing homes that spend down to get the Medicaid eligibility. 80 to 90% of the people in nursing homes are Medicaid eligible. So what are we going to do? We're going to cut the nursing homes? We're going to throw people out of nursing homes? We're going to leave the developmentally disabled without some kind of medical attention? What happens then? Then do our prisons become overcrowded? I mean, the question is, what are the choices? But people don't want to listen to the choices.
I'm going to encourage our audience here to line up at that microphone over here to begin to ask your questions. I know the first question will come from Public Radio Delmarva. And our sponsors, please get up there, and also the audience members who have questions about where to go. And as we do that, turn to the audience here. There are other issues that will be on the floor this year besides the economy.
Right.
Gay marriage clearly is at the top of the social and human issues that will be on the floor, and many people are saying this is the year that gay marriage will pass in the state of Maryland, allowing gay and lesbian citizens in this in our state to legally marry. Talk about what's going to happen to both of your institutions in that.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I have voted that marriage is between a man and a woman. I voted that. That's the law in Maryland right now. And that's where I voted, and I continue to believe that. I believe if anything happens to gay marriage, it'll happen in the Senate. It will probably come up early in the session. It'll be heard in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. I believe the votes are there in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee to bring the bill to the floor. The votes on whether it passes, I believe, are very close. The tough question is whether the votes are going to be there to get cloture. In other words, it'll be filibustered. You're not going to get a single Republican to vote for it, and fairly moderate conservative Democrats are not going to vote for it either. I have a huge African-American population in my constituency. The majority of them are not for gay marriages. So you're going to see African-American legislators opposed to it. You're going to see conservatives opposed to it. And so it's going to be a very lively debate. And so the question is, do we get cloture, and does it come to a vote? I'm going to vote for cloture. I'm going to try to bring the matter to vote. I believe the majority view should prevail. And if it does pass, I believe it'll pass the House, but I believe it'll be petitioned to referendum, and I believe it'll be on the ballot in 2012 so that the public itself will have an opportunity to vote on this matter.
I agree with the President of the Senate. I mean, I think part of it is what the terminology is. I mean, whether it's civil marriage, whether it's civil unions, what the terminology is. Currently, you have a Republican senator sponsoring a civil unions bill. You have Democratic senator sponsoring a civil marriage bill. What the differences in those are, I don't exactly know off the top of my head. But I do believe that if it comes from the Senate to the House, it'll get out of the Judiciary Committee. I have not counted the votes on the floor, but I think the terminology will play a big difference. In a General Assembly, we don't lobby each other on issues of gay marriage, abortion, death penalty. I mean, there are things that people have brought with them philosophically.
Well, where do you stand on gay marriage?
I believe in civil marriage. I believe that everybody should have the same civil rights. I believe that marriage itself is a quality of the religious organizations. I mean, some religions support gay initiatives, so you get married in those churches. Some do not. I don't believe we should get into the purview of the religious issues, but I do believe everyone should have the same civil rights in front of the law. And whether you call that civil marriage, civil unions, I believe that that's the appropriate direction to take. And I know it's a very contentious issue, but I believe that everyone, regardless of race, sexual orientation, should have the same rights in front of the
Just one last very question. I mean, would both of you vote yes or no on a gay marriage bill if it came up?
I'm voting no on gay marriage, and I'm voting no on civil unions.
I'd vote yes on civil unions, depending on what the terminology was for civil marriages.
And the follow-up question?
Let's go to the audience and identify yourself, please.
Hey, this is Don Rush from Public Radio Delmarva. And the question I had, actually, I was struck by the vehemence, I guess, about the idea that perhaps we shouldn't provide money to clean up the bay because we're asking, for instance, for state workers to be furloughed. Right. So I'm curious about how much we expect then that money to clean up the bay will be cut. Is that where you favor cutting it? How do you see this fitting into the EPA, which has set out its own guidelines to require states to clean up the bay? How does that fit into your budget plans? And as you probably know, the Farm Bureau Federation, the American Farm Bureau Federation, has said it's going to file suit to oppose that. Do you think that then the cleanup of the bay should be, say, left to the states rather than the feds? Where are you on this? And are you vigorously opposed, say, to expending more money on the cleaning of the bay?
No, I mean, the bay is the crown jewel of the state of Maryland. It's the largest estuary in the United States. I live on the Chesapeake Bay. You know, I wanted my legacy in politics to be two things, education and the bay. 3 years now, we're number one in education. Through Thornton for me. I'm going to continue that to be. I'm the oldest of 10 kids, went to a public school. I've lived in Southern Maryland my entire life, between the Potomac River, the Patuxent River, and the Chesapeake Bay. We need to preserve and protect our environment. And we're not going to back off from the Chesapeake Bay. We're going to continue to do the Chesapeake Bay. We've got these tough stormwater, storm drain regulations in place. And we're protecting the bay from nitrogen, from phosphorus, from sediment. You know, my area is a large farming area. You know, the chicken farmers are objecting, the livestock farmers are objecting, but somehow we're going to have to bring the farmers to the table. They're not the main polluters of the bay, but the sewer people, the people involved in the sewage that goes in the bay, they've got to be brought to heel. The builders of houses that build homes for Harry and Harriet homeowners that put the fertilizer on the lawns that go through the storm drains and the creeks and rivers, they've got to be brought to heel. And basically, the farmers as well. So it takes a little bit of everything. I support the EPA and the regulations. We're going to work to make those regulations work and preserve and protect the Chesapeake Bay. And we're going to continue to provide funding resources. But at the same time, these tough fiscal times, just like you don't want to knock people off the Medicaid rolls, you don't want to cut education. At the same time, we can't afford to do what we've been doing in terms of the Chesapeake Bay.
Let me just make a statement. I'm happy that the EPA has stepped in, but I hope the EPA is as stringent in their regulations with our neighboring states of Pennsylvania and Virginia, who put very little resources into protecting the bay compared to the state of Maryland. I mean, Maryland continues to make an investment in the bay, and I would say we are the chief stewards of it. But you cannot continue to put the type of money that we put into it and then have a storm come down the Susquehanna and bring all the waste from Pennsylvania here without some kind of oversight from the EPA. But it's also another example where the federal government comes in, puts regulatory oversight in, and does not identify a funding source to make it happen. So, I mean, while we've been very vigilant and have invested in the bay, it takes a regional approach to the Chesapeake Bay. And if the EPA is going to come in and mandate the type of regulations they want to mandate, I think they have an obligation to make sure that our neighboring states follow the same mandates the state of Maryland follows.
This is a quick follow-up. Because my understanding is the EPA decided to step in because the states were not doing this. They were not coordinating enough in order to cut back. And is there enough money to meet the EPA demands?
Well, I think the reason the EPA is involved because, you know, the bay starts up with the Susquehanna up in New York. I mean, that's the filtering in the bay. The reason is New York is not doing what it's doing. Pennsylvania is not doing what it's doing. And Virginia is not doing what it's doing. It takes all involved. You know, we brought the canvasback ducks back. We brought the rockfish back. We brought the crab back. Now we've got to bring the oysters back. But it involves all the states working together with the federal government. And thus far, we haven't had a unifying force. But now that we've got the federal government to look at, including with penalties, if we don't agree to these total maximum loads, I think we're going to finally see moving up from the D minuses maybe to the C minuses, maybe even a B plus and a B minus in my lifetime in terms of preserving and protecting the Chesapeake Bay.
Thank you, Don.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Gary Brennan. I'm from Walkersville, Maryland, and I'm an educator. And I keep hearing you talking about cuts to education.
Right.
And when you talk about large cuts to education, what you're really talking about is increasing class size. That's the only place you get a lot of money.
Right.
And educators and parents are very concerned about what increased class sizes mean for management of a classroom, individual attention to students. So I guess my question is, how can we avoid those kind of large class size increases if we cut education budgets, shift pension costs back to school systems? What do you see as the effect on the classroom to those kinds of big cuts?
Well, in Virginia and Colorado, Virginia, you know, eliminated some kindergarten funding, increased the class size from 1 to 3. I think it's probably a strong possibility. It was just 10 years ago in Calvert County when the classroom size was from 30 to 34 students. Because of our increased funding over the years, classes now are between 20 and 25 students. It's better teaching. We get better results. But at the same time, can we continue that level of funding? No. But at the same time, because we give our counties the piggyback income tax, we send $1 billion of money to Montgomery County. We send $60 million back to Calvert County to help them do that. No other state in the union does that, so the counties are going to have to do more with less, and hopefully they can help make the right choices.
It's a great question. I mean, I'm an individual that has two daughters in public schools, and I value the fact of the education opportunities they have there. And my whole goal has been to make Maryland number one. We've done that 3 years in a row. But the fact of the matter comes down to is you have to balance your budget. And when 50% of your budget is K through 12 education and higher education, and you're mandated through the federal government to fund Medicaid, if you're going to balance your budget, you have to cut somewhere in the areas of education. And it's not a happy thing to do, but I would suggest that the vast majority of counties have given significant raises and COLA increases to educators over the last 3 years, thanks to the Thornton money. Compared to state employees and other employees. Not that they don't deserve it, but I think in general they've done pretty well.
Guys, I'm from Frederick County. We haven't gotten a step increase or any kind of COLA for the last 3 years. So that's not true across the state.
Okay.
We're here in Annapolis, and we're going to have a very brief break here. We're here, of course, with President of the Senate Mike Miller, Speaker of the House Michael Bush, our live audience from the Calvert House here in Annapolis across from the state capitol. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here at the Annapolis Summit, and we are here with President of the Senate, Mike Miller, Speaker of the House, Michael Bush. People are getting ready to ask their questions here from the audience. And rather than I could monopolize this entire on myself with no problem whatsoever, but no problem. But I think to be in fairness to the people lined up, let's go back to our audience.
Mavis Ellis, NEA Director for Maryland. And we know over the next decade, thousands of baby boomer educators will be retiring. What are your priorities in terms of attracting great educators and retaining them?
Well, we've done that. Just a few years ago, Maryland's pension system was one of the lower pension systems in the United States. And we increased it by $140 million in 1 year. Without any funding source whatsoever to continue to attract the very best and brightest educators here in the state of Maryland. We've continued to put more funding in education than any state in the union. I met with the school superintendents just this week, and they said, we've been awash in money. They'd come from other states. Maryland is awash in money in terms of education compared to our sister states, and we'd like to continue to do that, and we're going to try to continue to do that. But at this very tight fiscal times, when we've raised taxes in 2007, I don't believe we're going to do it again in 2012. Now, the previous gentleman was from Frederick County. I mean, Frederick County, I mean, these rural areas are stuck in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. They have options, you know, a slip tax, a parking tax, hotel tax, amusement tax, transfer tax. They haven't taken advantage of any of these things to help fund education. They've relied on property taxes, and we've given them our piggyback income tax so they can hold their property taxes down, but at the same time, they haven't used the other taxes available to them to help provide for education. The counties are going to have to step up to the plate and help do what they're supposed to do.
So taxes are in our future, if that's the case.
Well, it depends on local level. Let me suggest this. I would hope that the fact that Maryland's been number one in education for 3 years in a row, we have the highest percentage of college graduates in the workforce, would encourage educators that want to teach and be part of that system to come to the state of Maryland. I think that educators that want to be around a vibrant system want to be in a state like Maryland where you continue to be number one, where we continue to prioritize education. So I believe that educators are attracted to the state of Maryland, and I think that will continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. A quick question here before it gets away. Another issue that's going to come and be debated in both your houses in Annapolis this year will be issues around immigration. There are those who want to introduce bills to produce a Maryland statewide DREAM Act that allows young people to go to college who may be documented or undocumented workers and students in this state. And there are others who want to introduce bills to have a mimic of the Arizona law, which allows police to stop anybody they suspect of being not a United States citizen. So that debate's going to take place. So what happens in your houses around these two questions?
Well, you know, the Tea Party, they just threw up the phrase illegal immigration. Vote against anything connected with illegal immigration. But, I mean, it's a very gray area. For example, there's a bill which George Bush signed when he was governor of Texas. There's a bill which Governor Huckabee signed when he was governor of Arkansas. There's a bill, it's a law in Utah and Kansas, and that same bill is being proposed in Maryland, okay? And what it does is saying if somebody is a child of an illegal, and the child goes through the Maryland school system, and the child graduates, and the parents are living, even though they might be illegal, they're living in Maryland, and they're paying taxes, and they've paid income taxes for the last 3 years, they're paying the sales taxes at the store, withholding, Social Security, and things of that nature, and they're on their way to citizenship. They haven't done it yet, but they sign up, they're going to commit to be citizens. Does that child get in-state tuition at a community college? Well, the answer should be yes. I mean, it should be yes, you know. But at the same time, you're going to get probably all the Republicans voting against it, even though George Bush supported it, Huckabee supported it, and you're going to get some conservative Democrats against it.
You say community college, Mr. President. What about University of Maryland, Towson University?
You know, you've got to take a baby step before you can take a giant step. There are people that are afraid that that the children of these immigrants are going to keep others out of the higher education system, out of Stevenson University, out of the University of Maryland, out of Towson, out of Salisbury. Our states are becoming our state colleges are very competitive to get into. And so now what we request is that some students, in fact, the majority of our students, start off in a community college. And if they get a certain grade point average, then they can transfer to higher education, the higher education system of their choice. But I believe a compromise that's going to be proposed is that it apply first to community colleges.
First of all, right. I think this directly is a reflection of the dysfunctionality of the federal government. I mean, you have to have a comprehensive immigration program. The federal government states that if you're here legally, illegally, that as a child, you have to go to school. So if you're 6 years old and you came here when you were three, you have to go through the education system. You go through the education system, you get out, the only thing you've known is the community you've lived in, and now you have to be treated as an out-of-state student if you want to go to a four-year university or community college. Doesn't mean they can't get in. You can get in currently right now. Part of the problem is going to be now with the Real ID Act is all these kids that do not have citizenship here that go through, get out of college, even if they pay to go themselves, they can't have a driver's license, and they can't fly out of your airports. So they get a degree here. Most of them are going to go offshore to some other country and take that degree that they've got in the state of Maryland and the United States of America and leave. It's a shame that the federal government doesn't deal with this. The DREAM Act, which should have passed in Congress as far as I'm concerned, would have been for both military and kids that went into college that they would sign for American citizenship. There's no guarantee if you sign for American citizenship in the state of Maryland that you're going to be granted it at the federal level. So, I mean, you need a comprehensive solution to this. But I agree with the President of the Senate. These kids come here 2 or 3 years old. The only thing they've known is the neighborhoods they've grown up here. They will not be able to get a license at age 16. They will not be able to drive. If they don't go on to get a college education, the most likely thing is they're going to get involved in some activity that is not legal. The highest growth in gang-related issues in the Montgomery County area are immigrant kids.
Yes, we have these.
And you talk about the community college. I mean, you know, that's sort of a compromise. Now, the proponents of it are not going to like it, but at the same time, you know, I know the votes in the Senate, I know the votes in the House, and unless a compromise such as that is proposed, it's not going to pass. The feelings against it are so strong. The polls against it. I don't do polling, but I know where the public is. So you ask the public right now would be 80% against it, 80, 85 against it. Just on the sound bites alone. It's very difficult to explain in paragraphs what somebody can say in a sound bite. And if it came up with the ideal way that the proponents wish it, it would go down in resounding defeat in both the Senate committee and on the floor of the Senate.
Let me say this. I don't think there's support there for the Arizona law. You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, how do you identify someone that you think is not an American citizen? The largest immigrant population on the Eastern Shore is from the Soviet Union area, Russia, the Slovak countries.
Poland.
If you go down there, they're the ones that also use the health care. I mean, you know, if you can't get health care, you use the emergency room. You can't be denied coverage of the emergency room. That's a federal mandate. It's the EMPALA laws.
No, we know who will get stopped.
Right.
It won't be Russians, Polish, and Ukrainian immigrants, documented, undocumented. Who will get stopped will be people who are...
Don't look like me.
Exactly.
It might be you with your beard.
Could be me.
Yeah,
now, I've been stopped before.
I'm sure you have.
They let me go when I say, but I know Mike Miller.
No. Or Joe Valerio.
Over here, the mic again.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Eric Naumberg. I'm a pediatrician. I'm with Physicians for a National Health Program. I have a suggestion for you, that something you might want to look into, where I think the state could save a lot of money in the Medicaid program. About 40% of the revenues in Medicaid go through Health Choice, the MCO, through the MCOs, the privately administered part of the program, and they run administrative costs in the range of 15% or higher. That's administration and profits. The public part of the program, which often is, to a certain extent, is made out of carve-outs of the most disabled people and the sickest children, runs as a fee-for-service publicly administered program. They run about 2% or less administrative costs. In 2007, that difference was about $275 million. The program has grown by 40 or 50% since then, so I assume that the difference now is close to $350 or $400 million, which would be quite a savings for the state and also the federal government. So I'm wondering what you think about looking into that idea.
The thing I can tell you is 8 years ago we set up a committee strictly to do with health care. I think we have one of the best legislators in the state, and Pete Hammond is the chairman of that committee. We look for ways every year to save money and increase the roles for eligibility within the state of Maryland. We certainly look at that. I mean, we've done everything we can over the years to progressively try to save money as well as create access. And we will continue to look in that direction.
I'd like to see you go to a Medicare for All system in the state of Maryland eventually, but I know that's not happening anytime soon. So anyway, thank you.
Which I think they're introducing in Vermont. And they're also going to battle in some other places whether it should be tantamount to a single-payer system in each state. In states. I mean, it seems like all these things are falling back to the states.
Well,
this is where the arguments are going to take place.
You know, we've spent an inordinate amount of time here in the interim with one of the best health secretaries in the country, and he's just been replaced by another outstanding individual, of trying to correlate and integrate the Maryland healthcare system with the Obama medical plan that was passed in Congress. I mean, I think it's tough to start another program when you have a national program that's going to be implemented in a incremental way that deals with your state health care delivery system. And I think that we will be better at that than most states at doing that, but it's tough to vary off that when the federal guidelines are going to set certain mandates that you have to follow a year or 2 years down the road.
Another tax question, then we'll come right back to the audience. What we like to imbibe. Vinnie DeMarco is asking for an alcohol tax, a dime a drink. Other people are saying we have to start taxing purchases of wine, whiskey, beer. Those things have not gone up in years as well. And the argument being that if a man or woman wants to drink, they're going to buy it no matter how much it costs.
Right.
So are we there?
It's nonsense.
Nonsense.
I mean, it would be applied at the wholesale level, and what it amount to it would be $5 on a case of beer. It's total nonsense. You know, if you double the beer tax right now, he wants $200 million. If you double the beer tax right now for what it is right now, it only raises $9 million. I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to increase taxes on wine. I'm willing to increase taxes on alcohol, light liquor, spirits. But at the same time, like I say, the power to tax is the power to destroy. That's confiscatory. It's not going to happen. I don't diminish Mr. DeMarco and his group and his thinking. But at the same time, you know, not quite a similar proposal was proposed in Massachusetts, which raised maybe one-third of the level they're seeking, went to the voters' referendum, and repealed overwhelmingly. The same thing would happen in Maryland. It's just not going to happen. We raised the taxes on cigarettes, and rightfully so. But what's happening is people in Western Maryland are going to Western Virginia. They're going to Pennsylvania. They're going to Virginia, and they're saving $17 on a carton of cigarettes. $17 on a carton of cigarettes. And they go by there. They go to the Best store. They go to the Costco store. They go to Walmart store. They buy their gas. They buy their groceries and what have you. And it's hurting Maryland salespeople. It's hurting Maryland revenues. So at the same time, you have to have a sane tax structure. And that would be insanity personified.
Mike Bush?
Look, I think you need to have a structured tax program. I mean, I tend to agree with the President of the Senate. I think that there's people there that would double the current tax structure. I don't know exactly how Mr. DeMarco's plan works as far as raising $200 million. I know that if we doubled the current beer tax on beer or alcohol or wine, it raises maybe about $20 million. But obviously it's going to be there. It's going to have a hearing. The question is, do you get the support of 71 people to do that, or do you get 24 people in the Senate to do that? I think that, you know, if you're going to build a bridge until the economy improves, I think you have to find some kind of funding sources as well as cuts.
Let me go back to that, because it's just this thing we keep hearing, funding sources versus cuts, and every state in the union is facing it, the country is facing it. And I come back to where I almost began this conversation, which is, are we at a point in our state and country where we cannot... I hate to sound so negative about it, but no. We cannot meet the needs that people expect.
No, it'll
in our
turn back again. I'm a historian. Things go in cycles. This will turn back again. You know, the people are going to get so sick and tired of this Tea Party business that, again, the progressive movement will take hold in the state and we'll move back. It'll shift back again. Honestly, truly, it'll happen. It might take 5 years, it might take 10 years, it might take 15 years again, but it will.
Look, I think the problem that you're having here is not with the taxes, it's with people's everyday energy costs. Gas has gone from $2 a gallon to over $3 a gallon, and it's been there for a few years. Your health care costs, people can't get health care anymore, so they're paying out of pocket, they're paying higher premiums. That's what's driving the cost of the average consumer. I pay less in taxes today, than I paid 20 years ago. I mean, so the fact that I think taxes have been a problem, they're not a problem. I think the cost... And the fact that inflation hasn't kept up, personal growth and income haven't kept up with inflation, has caused people concerns. And everybody thought that they could buy a house with no money down, no interest, and they could live in an extraordinary fashion. That has come back to haunt everybody, particularly the guy that paid his mortgage on time. So I think there's a lot of frustration out there with the way government is run and the way the regulatory system is run. And much of that is through the financial systems that really caused this recession.
And maybe people will stand up for that. I mean, those of us who find our homes underwater, not what they're worth when we bought them.
Right.
And the rest, over here.
Good morning. Allison Prose, Chesapeake Bay Foundation. I wanted to follow up on the first question related to the environment and the budget. I want to know, do you see, in the absence of additional new funding, are there ways, though, that we can do funding for the environment and the local jobs that they often create? Do you all see any possibilities with that respect?
We have to think out of the box. For example, one of the bills that we sponsored last year was the creation of a Chesapeake Conservation Corps, which is sort of like the CCC in the Depression. We've got young people being hired, being assigned to all of the various environmental agencies, working to bring back and restore the rivers, the bays, and what have you. So that's just one innovative idea that we've have adopted, and hopefully we can think of a dozen others with your help.
Yeah, look, I think that we've made every opportunity and every effort to protect the bay and our environmental priorities. Even in the toughest of times, we've continued to fully fund program Open Space. Many people that, like yourself, that protect the bay, believe protect the land, you protect the bay and the tributaries. There'll be a question whether we will increase the fee for the upgrade of water treatment plants and storage plants as we go through this to limit runoff into the tributaries in the bay. The Chesapeake Conservation Corps has been a great idea initiated in the Senate. I think that's a benefit. I think the fact that we've invested $20 million in the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay for the last 2 years in the toughest economic times speaks to the commitment that Governor O'Malley and the General Assembly have had to the Bay.
My one quick follow-up to that is, as we see the budget process continue, and if there are cuts to environmental programs, what is the political will for some maybe tougher environmental policies to demonstrate the priority that Maryland has for the Bay and the environment?
You're going to see tougher environmental policies when these regulations come out from EPA in terms of preserving the Chesapeake Bay. You're going to hear people squealing. In fact, the American Farmers Association is filing suit.
They filed
right
on Monday.
Now, filing suit to block these regulations. So it's going to be litigious. We're going to work through it, but we're going to preserve and protect and restore the Chesapeake Bay.
And follow up with that, we keep talking about farmers, and farming has a huge amount to do with the phosphorus and nitrogen that goes into our water.
Right.
However, perhaps the largest polluters of our bay are the vehicles we drive, runoff from our cars, are the chemicals we put on our lawns, what goes into the sewage plants. In fact, it's going to cost $10 to $20 billion to refurbish. Right. The water treatment in the state of Maryland. I mean, that's the bottom line. I mean, farmers have to do their share, but we keep always talking about farmers. We're not talking about the way we live our lives, period, has to change.
Well, the state of Maryland is second to none in terms of clean air and clean water. Honestly, any idea that's in it, we get complaints because we're too close to California in terms of adopting environmental cars, greenhouses, preserving set-offs of the Chesapeake Bay and critical areas, tough environmental restrictions. I mean, we are working very hard, diligently as a state, to move forward in terms of our rules and regulations to preserve the Chesapeake Bay.
I mean, all these are tough challenges. I mean, you have 5.5 million people here. I mean, if you asked 3 million to leave and you only had 2 million people here, it'd be a lot easier on the Bay. So, we'll ask for volunteers to clean up the Bay by volunteering to leave the state. What do you think, Mark? Huh? Can you start that effort?
Sure, I'll
want to come here because you've got a vibrant workplace, you've got a great education system, you're around the Chesapeake Bay, and you got to balance the overall welfare and all that with the people who want to reside in the state of Maryland. And the legislature can't be a catch-all for everything. I mean, there does have to come a point of individual responsibility and people standing up and saying, we believe in these services, we want to do this, and come to Annapolis and make it happen. They just can't sit back and say, no.
Yes. Next question.
Hi, Jen Brock Cancellieri with the Maryland League of Conservation Voters.
Right.
I wanted to ask a question about energy. This coming session, the environmental community is partnering with the labor community, Port of Baltimore, the Maryland Energy Administration, to work on a policy that will bring offshore wind to Maryland by requiring utilities sign long-term purchasing power agreements with offshore wind companies to bring reliable jobs here to the state, 5,000 construction jobs, 800 ongoing jobs, reliable price, reliable energy supply, and a reliable climate. So I wanted to get your feelings on that policy and what you think the General Assembly can do to bring offshore wind to Maryland.
I'm for wind power. I'm for offshore wind, but it's very costly. I mean, it's extremely costly. And just like we mandated to the utility companies that they provide a certain percentage of solar energy, it's very costly, so it's passed on to consumers. So we're going to have to look at the cost factor before we engage in mandating it, but it's certainly something we'd hope that some private enterprise would take it on, but at the same time, it looks like it's not going to happen without some a push from the government, and we're going to have to look at the cost factor involved.
I do think that we should have wind energy up in Western Maryland 5 years ago, quite candidly. I'm supportive of wind energy, offshore wind energy. I think that's the way to go. I think that we've set standards for portfolios to have alternative energies other than fossil-burning fuels. I think that's been established. I hope that Maryland continues to go forward in a way that our portfolio of energy here continues to have not only natural energy, but also I hope that we go forward with the initiatives down at Calvert Cliffs as well.
I mean, and what you said a moment ago, Mike Miller, if we are serious about clean energy, in the state and this country, it's going to cost a lot of money and be a 20, 30-year transition to get there. Whether you put nuclear into the mix or whether you have wind and solar or whatever that argument is going to be, and that's and then some people have argued on my show recently around wind power, is that we're not sure what the environmental effect of putting wind out in the ocean is to the water and what's under it. I mean, there are a lot of issues here that are that we have to wrestle with in an honest way are very tough to confront.
Let me suggest this to you too. I mean, that's what the federal government should be engaged in: a national energy policy, a national health care policy, and a national immigration policy. The idea that somehow that transmission is going to run through Maryland and not affect Pennsylvania or not affect New Jersey just is not a viable source. You have to have all these states in a regional area engaged. So you have to bring the PGM into effect, which is the initials for the states that are involved with it. So if you have a coalition of states, Middle Atlantic states, Northeast states, you start to get some things accomplished. It's very tough to do it state by state. While states try to struggle with those initiatives, the federal government's really the ones that have to step up and give us a national policy.
Back to the mic.
Hi, I'm Margaret Flowers. I am a pediatrician. I did my training here in Maryland and practiced here in Maryland, but now I work, actually volunteer full-time for a state or national publicly financed health system. I serve as congressional fellow for my organization as well, so I'm aware of what's going on in D.C. And the Affordable Care Act fails to address the fundamental problems that we have with health care. It's not going to be universal. It's going to put increased administrative cost on the state, not control our health care costs. So it's kind of an example of what's been done over and over at the state level, which is to try to patch together what we have, and it hasn't worked. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot. We're losing doctors. Our health care costs are rising out of control. It's putting an unfair burden on businesses, dragging them down, making our wages stagnant, causing families to go bankrupt due to medical costs, lose their homes. If we looked at a state or national, but here in the state, a state single-payer health system, We could solve those problems. We could reduce our health care costs in the state and provide universal health care to everyone. It is being done in Vermont. We're excited about that. They are planning to get the waivers at the federal level that they're going to need to implement that system. There are 20 states now around the country looking to them to lead the way for us. And I'm asking you if you would seriously consider investigating a state's publicly financed, privately delivered health system here in Maryland.
We've tried to address that in numerous different ways here. Our goal is always to expand healthcare accessibility. Part of the problem, once again, is you have federal regulations called ERISA. If you can self-insure, you cannot have your insurance commissioner oversee how they buy their health insurance and how it's distributed. So large corporations have the ability to self-insure. The issue is we try to fill the gap between Medicaid and those who don't have access to insurance. We've done it through the Children's Health Insurance Program, better known as CHIPS. We've done it through increased eligibility for those in the Medicaid system. So we've tried to continue to expand our health care coverage. The question is, as you've pointed out, that you have to get the federal waivers. And we've been very successful in trying to get the federal waivers. We are trying to follow, in some respects, the Vermont model, but we'll see where we go from there. But our goal has always been to cover and have affordable, accessible health care for as many individuals as we have. And we appreciate the interest and the debate and look forward to your presentation in the Health Government Operations Committee.
Thank you.
I support that. Thank you.
Director Cannon, should single-payer be on the table as a debate for the state to consider?
Let me just reiterate. It's very tough for single-payer system to be implemented at the state level because individual businesses have the right to self-insure. Then they come under the protection of what's known as the ERISA waiver, which was a retirement issue. So if you're Constellation Energy, our insurance commissioner doesn't regulate anything you do as far as the purchase of your health care system. You self-insure, somebody writes it up, you go out and hire someone as a third-party administrator. Most of this is pretty complex stuff, and people want to sometimes break it down in the terms that aren't easily accomplished.
We have about a minute left in this segment before the governor comes up. Anything you want to end up with in the last 30 seconds here?
Civil unions. Okay, people say, why do I support civil unions? In France, they have civil unions. They thought it was a help for the gay community. It's used by the straight community. The majority of marriages in France are by, you know, civil unions. You know, I'm the oldest of 10 kids. I got 5 kids. I got 13 grandkids. What happens to the children now? You know, the people live together. They're going to engage in a civil union. They have 2 and 3 kids. And you know what you do? You send somebody a registered letter. Goodbye. Sayonara. It's it. Goodbye. I think it makes no sense whatsoever. In my opinion, it's a breakdown in society.
Well, there's nobody to get into this now, so we have to end. See what happens. That's a good ploy there, Senator President Miller. Mike Miller and Mike Bush, thank you so much for joining us here at the Annapolis Summit. We're going to take a brief break and come back with Governor Martin O'Malley. And I'll remind you the Annapolis Summit is hosted by the Baltimore Business Journal, WEA Radio, the Center for Emerging Media, the producers of the Mark Steiner Show, Stevenson University, the Maryland State Education Association, the Greater Baltimore Committee, and Public Radio Del Marva, of course, what we're broadcasting as well, and thank the Mayor's Office of Cable and Communications in Baltimore City, Channel 25, for taping and putting this on the air as well. Stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Governor Martin O'Malley.